Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, August 4th, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we will discuss the future of fintech regulation. My name is Wes Hodges, and I am the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Brian Knight, Senior Research Fellow in the Financial Markets Working Group at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. We also have John W. Ryan, President and Chief Executive Officer at Conference of State Bank Supervisors. And moderating today, we have Wayne Abernathy, Executive Vice President for Financial Institutions, Policy and Regulatory Affairs at the American Bankers Association. I'll turn it over to Wayne to get us started. After your discussion, we will move to audience Q&A. Thank you for speaking with us. Wayne, the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you very much, Wes, and welcome to everybody who's calling in and listening in today. Very glad to have you joining with us. Again, my name is Wayne Abernathy. I'm an Executive Vice President at the American Bankers Association. I'm also Chairman of the Executive Committee of the Federalist Society's Practice Group on Financial Services, and I'm thrilled to be able to moderate our discussion today. I hope you'll find it very informative, as I expect that you will. There has been much recent attention to technology's promise of beneficial effects for financial services. This innovation can be apparent to financial services customers, as well as reaching to important improvements and efficiencies that take place in the background in how financial transactions are processed, products developed, and delivery costs lowered. Innovation is not foreign to financial services, as is demonstrated by life-changing innovations that are now commonplace, like credit and debit cards, ATMs, the wide range of securities products, and tools such as swaps, derivatives, and insurance to help with managing the risks of life. In the United States, all of that takes place in an elaborate regulatory environment. We have two very distinguished experts with us today to discuss some of that, what we can in the brief time that we have for this teleforum. Our format will be as follows. First, I will turn to Brian Knight, again, who's the Senior Research Fellow for the Financial Markets Working Group at the Mercatus Center at the George Mason University. After Brian makes some comments, I'll then turn to John Ryan to offer his remarks. John Ryan is President and CEO of the Conference of State Bank Supervisors. And for those of you who may not be familiar with it, CSBS, that is the organization of all of the state's banking and finance commissioners, a very distinguished group that stretches across the whole nation. After a brief opportunity for interaction between Brian and John, we will then go to you, the callers, for any questions that you would like to offer up. And with that introduction, let me go right to Brian Knight. The floor is yours.
Thanks, Wayne. So as Wayne mentioned, innovation is not new in the financial services space. So when we talk about fintech at its broadest level, what we're talking about is the application of technology to financial services, and that's been around since at least metal coinage, if not before. So for our purposes, we're going to have to narrow down the discussion. And so the way I view it is that what we're talking about, why this matters currently, is that technology is allowing for new means of providing or facilitating services, or at least relatively new means. These new means have the potential to expand access and improve the quality of financial services, and there's some academic research that shows that that's happening. And particularly important for our discussion today, it allows for new providers for services because the costs of entering the market and the cost of effectively providing a type of service to compete have come down thanks to technology. And so what we see are a lot of non-bank firms entering various spaces that have traditionally and competing at levels that have traditionally been occupied by more traditional banks. In particular, for example, we have lending and the rise of so-called marketplace or peer-to-peer lenders, and money transmission, where non-bank money transmission firms, ranging from relatively well-established ones like PayPal, which has been around for a while, or newer firms that are leveraging distributed ledger technology as a means of transferring money, are entering the space and trying to compete with more established incumbents. While that has resulted in more competition, it's resulted in expanded access, it's also placed stress on the existing regulatory system and the assumptions underlying that regulatory system. And one big area where that's happened is the fact that these are non-banks who are competing with banks. And thanks to the technology, there's no geographic limitation to the scope of how they can provide services. But there is a regulatory limitation in that they are regulated primarily at the state level, and they lack some of the regulatory advantages that federal law grants to banks, both state banks and national banks, and lack the comity that certain states grant state banks to effectively compete at a national level. And in particular, I would highlight the ability to export one's home state interest law, which bank, state and federal banks enjoy, and the need to obtain money transmitter licenses in each state that you provide services in, where national banks are not required to obtain money transmitter licenses, and most states exempt other state banks from having to obtain money transmitter licenses, whereas non-banks have to go state by state, apply for the license, get the license, and are regulated at a state level almost entirely, whereas, let me back up, not almost entirely in the sense that there isn't federal regulation. Even among banks, there is both state and federal regulation that applies, but for certain important areas at the national level, there tends to be greater national consistency, whereas for non-banks, there's more state-by-state variation, and you have to comply with each state's law. This results in three potential harms. The first is inefficiency, the second is competitive inequity, and the third is political inequity. The inefficiency is relatively straightforward. It's expensive to get licenses. It's difficult and time-consuming to do all of that. It's also difficult, time-consuming, and expensive to continue to monitor each state's law to test for any or to check for any variations, changes that would necessitate a change in your compliance protocol. It's also inefficient if you can't obtain a consistent product nationwide and achieve economies of scale. One of the great advantages that banks have is that they can offer a consistent product to similarly situated customers nationwide with regards to the type of interest, what constitutes interest, the type of interest that they charge, how they structure their loans. In terms of money transmission, they can basically operate across state lines, generally without having to require an additional license. And so this gives them this is both efficient and allows for lower prices and easier access. It also grants banks a competitive advantage over their non-bank competitors who are providing functionally equivalent services. And finally, on the political side, there's the risk that certain states, by virtue of their position in the financial services industry or just their size or wealth or importance, effectively regulate the national market. And the New York Department of Financial Services, in a lawsuit, in a complaint they filed against the OCC over the OCC's fintech charter, which we'll discuss in more detail a little later, it kind of acknowledged as much by saying that because New York is so important to the global financial system, the New York Department of Financial Services is in effect a global financial regulator. The challenge there is that the New York Department of Financial Services doesn't face global political accountability. If you are in Texas or Virginia or Colorado or any other state, you really don't have any means of democratic redress to influence the NYDFS. And so you have people who are being regulated under a situation where they just don't have any say in the regulation. It's not that they're guaranteed get their opinions validated or to win the regulatory discussion. They just can't even participate effectively. And these problems have led to, or these issues have led to some workarounds that these non-bank firms have pursued. And one of the big ones is it's encouraged these non-banks to work with banks, to partner with banks. We see this in particular in the lending context, where non-bank lenders will partner with a bank. Often it's a bank chartered out of Utah or New Jersey or a state that has either it does not have a usury limit or has strong contractual rules or something like that that enables the firm to not have to deal with the borrower state usury limit, and they will make loans that way, where the bank will initially make the loan and then sell the loan to the non-bank lender, who will then service the loan. And so the non-bank lender handles marketing, you know, attracting the lender on the front end. They do underwriting. The bank does underwriting. The bank and the lender agree to make a loan, and then the bank sells the loan to the non-bank lender. And this gets around the regulatory problem of the state-by-state regulation, but it adds cost because the state bank has to be compensated. It adds complexity, and it adds regulatory uncertainty. And we're seeing that regulatory uncertainty particularly acutely in some recent, as a result of some recent litigation and regulatory actions. The biggest one is the Madden versus Midland funding decision coming out of the second U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, which in a case that didn't involve any sort of fintech firm, it involved a credit card debt that had gone into default. The Second Circuit held that a loan that was made by the bank that was legal when the bank made it because of the bank's ability to export its home state interest law lost its validity once it was sold to a non-bank. And that turned well over a century of common law expectation on its head. And while that particular case did not involve an innovative lender, you can see the parallels in the model between selling a debt to a debt collector and a bank selling a debt to a marketplace lender for servicing. The other area where there's where that model is seeing a significant regulatory pressure is on the question of true lender. And so in the Madden case, there was no debate as to who the true lender was. The bank that issued the credit card was the true lender. They expected the customer to remain their customer through the duration of the life of the arrangement. It's only when the loan went bad that they sold it. The non-bank lenders, the question of true lender is a more acute one, which is if a bank partners with a non-bank lender with the understanding that the bank is going to sell all or even most of the loan to a non-bank, who's the true lender in that? And the reason that matters is some courts have held that if the bank isn't the quote-unquote true lender, then the loan should be treated under the law that would apply to the non-bank. And while some courts, the true lender jurisprudence is a bit of a muddle, and some courts have taken a contractual view, which is if your loan contract says you are getting a loan from a bank, then you've gotten a loan from a bank, and that's what applies. Others have taken a view that what you need to do is look at the predominant economic interest in the loan. If who stands to gain the most if the loan goes well and lose the most if the loan goes poorly, and that's the entity who's the true lender. And we are seeing a case in Colorado where the Colorado bank regulator or financial services regulator has brought a lawsuit against a couple of marketplace lenders making that argument and actually relying on both the valid one made and true lender arguments to say these loans, yes, they are technically made by a bank, but the marketplace lender is the true lender, and therefore the law that would apply to the marketplace lender should govern the loan. And that the bank, even if the bank was the lender, once they sold the loan, the interest export no longer applies. all of this, this uncertainty, the inefficiency, the competitive inequity, it really risks harming consumers. And in the wake of the Madden decision, it's been shown that credit availability to more marginal borrowers, so borrowers with lower credit scores, those who are least well served by the traditional financial system and most well served by these innovative firms, has dried up considerably because no one wants to fund a loan that might be found to be invalid. And so the current regulatory system, or at least I would argue that the current regulatory system presents certain problems. Well, what can we do about that? And one of the things that the OCC is attempting to do is they are, and we can discuss recent statements by the OCC call into question exactly how they plan to address it. But the OCC had announced in 2016 that they were going to move forward with a special purpose national bank charter for non-depository financial technology firms offering lending and money transmission services. This would allow those firms to tap into the existing body of law that governs national banks, including things like interest rate export, not having to get a lending license in each state, not having to get a money transmission license in each state. It would also integrate fintech firms into the banking regulatory regime more fully because they would be chartered banks. This was a controversial move, and it resulted in both the CSBS and the New York Department of Financial Services filing lawsuits to stop the OCC from issuing the charter. The arguments made were, generally that the OCC has exceeded its authority, that Congress I don't think there's much debate that if Congress wanted to, under the Interstate Commerce Clause, the federal government could have authority over non-depository financial services companies. But the question is, did Congress actually grant the OCC this authority, or is the OCC exceeding its authority by chartering non-depository institutions absent an explicit congressional grant of authority? There is also a procedural objection raised that the OCC should have followed Administrative Procedures Act notice and comment rulemaking, and instead what the OCC did is they released a series of white papers saying, we're thinking about doing this, give us feedback. Well, here's a draft amendment to the chartering manual. What do you think? And so there's this cycle of information being put out and solicitation of response, but not under the ABA or APA requirements. And then, those are the legal arguments. The policy arguments were more, and John's certainly going to touch on this more, that an OCC charter would harm consumers by denying them the benefits of state consumer protection law. It would harm the stability of the dual banking system because it would remove certain financial services companies from the state regulatory, not state banking system, but state regulatory system, and put them into the national banking system. So there would be this imbalance between the state banking system and the national banking system. That the OCC charter would harm competition and innovation because the OCC would be able to sort of pick and choose who it wanted to grant this charter to and would, in effect, be picking winners and losers. The OCC's response, which they just filed with the appropriate number of footnotes this time, since their first one got dinged for too many footnotes, is, as I read it anyway, basically that the CSBS and NYDFS, and these are two separate lawsuits, but they run on largely parallel tracks, that the CSBS complaint is premature because the OCC hasn't actually finalized its non-depository fintech charter plan yet. It hasn't received any applications. It hasn't granted any charters. So whatever the underlying merits, there's not a case or controversy yet. And so the courts should not be involved in this. On a more substantive level, they've argued that Congress has in fact authorized the OCC to do this type of thing because it's given the OCC fairly broad power to define what the business of banking is and manage the national banking system, and that the national banking system and the definition of what is a bank should evolve as the market evolves, and that the OCC is entitled to deference as to and how it defines the business of banking. And finally, that that bringing fintechs into the banking system is, in fact, good for the system because it allows for greater stability and greater oversight, and is good for competition and innovation because these firms are currently at a competitive disadvantage being outside of the banking system, A. But then B, that national banks are arguably at a competitive disadvantage for other regulatory reasons, things like the lack of or the perceived lack of oversight or capital requirements and the other bank requirements that banks have to face that fintechs arguably don't. And so you have the OCC argument, at least as I read it, is sort of like this levels the playing field on both sides. The fintechs get the export and the underlying law that enables national competition. The banks get to have the fintechs held to similar standards in terms of oversight and regulation. So that's the OCC, fintech charter litigation, at least at 30,000 feet. But that's not the only thing that can be done to address these regulatory problems, and hopefully it isn't the only thing that's done. Federal regulators have other things that they could be doing that I think it's going to be less politically controversial, or at least less legally controversial. The states have undertaken some efforts, and hopefully they'll be expanded. And then Congress can get involved. So briefly, one of the other things the federal banking regulators could do, the OCC and the FDIC, is they could, by regulation, address the Madden issue and potentially TrueLender as well. The OCC has already taken the position before the Supreme Court that the Second Circuit got it wrong, and that part of a bank's power to make a loan is to sell that loan and to have that loan remain valid when it's sold, and that cutting or reducing the validity of the loan, depending on who it's sold to, harms the bank's power to lend and the bank's power to sell its loans by reducing the potential market for those loans. So to the extent that the OCC and the FDIC generally interprets its powers or the powers of state banks as equivalent to national banks, that's an area where they could pursue via regulation a fix. The states have launched Vision 2020, which I'm sure John will talk more about, and it's their effort to modernize state regulation to make it easier for financial technology firms. So far, at least to my eyes, it appears to be focused on helping the firm handle multi-state application and examination and not the underlying legal inconsistencies issues. But the project is in early days, so we don't know where it's going to go from there. But states could also, on their own motion, grant greater reciprocity. There's nothing that prevents them at the state level from coming up with compacts or reciprocity agreements to allow firms to operate in multiple states on the basis of a license or to export certain parts of their law across state lines. The states could do all of that themselves if they wished. And finally, there's Congress, who has the most power, and they could fix Madden via legislation, and there are actually bills pending that would seek to do just that. They have the option to expand the definition of state bank for exporting purposes to include non-depositories. The Federal Deposit Insurance Act, which grants the state banks the ability to export their interest rate or the laws governing interest, it limits it to insured state banks. So depository institutions or institutions that at least went and got depository insurance. Congress could change that to allow for true non-depositories to also enjoy that, which would in turn allow states to offer charters that are comparable to what the OCC is is at least talking about doing. And I should back up for a second because I missed mentioning that the OCC in a recent speech has kind of hedged on whether, you know, whether or not they're actually going to pursue this model. They've been unequivocal in the fact that they have the right to do it, but they have said that we haven't made up our mind whether we're actually going to do it or not. But if the Congress were to change the FDIA, states could also say, well, we want to pursue a non-depository bank charter and move forward. And then finally, there's nothing that says that this has to be tied to being a bank. So Congress could change the laws to allow for passporting or exportation of licenses for state-licensed lenders and money transmitters. And that's kind of what they did with state-chartered banks when they granted that exportation. There was nothing that prevented the states themselves from doing it, but Congress assessed that it was necessary from a practical point of view for them to do it, and so they did, to allow state banks to more effectively compete with national banks. They could grant exportation or passporting to state-licensed lenders, state-licensed money transmitters, without those entities having to become banks. And so, those are at least some of the issues as I see it, and some of the potential solutions that could apply at both the state, federal, and sort of in a mixed way. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Wayne.
Great. Thank you very much, Brian. You've placed some interesting and important issues on the table. We've been listening to Brian Knight, Senior Research Fellow for the Financial Markets Working Group at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Now let's turn to John Ryan, who is the President and CEO of the Conference of State Bank Supervisors. John, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Wayne, and thanks, Brian, for setting up the discussion. And I think Brian's covered a number of things, so I will narrow my remarks. As both Wayne and Brian mentioned, you know, innovation in our financial system is as old as our financial system. And these issues of the role of the federal government and the role of the states are as old as our democracy. And I do feel a need in most settings in reminding the audience of why we have a state system of financial regulation and its value. I think that I probably have to spend less time on that with the members of this organization than others, given the mission of the Federalist Society. But it probably bears value in repeating that the history of corporate law, and as a subset, banking law in the United States, is a storied one and that has had very foundational significance to our economy and our democracy, and has been a part of the key concept of a separation of powers. The limited role of the federal government and the primacy of the states around the creation of a corporate existence is arguably the source of the diversity in the United States at the corporate level and the banking level. So this applies both to bank charters and all corporate entities and to entrepreneurism, as well as, and this is important to note, a key check and balance in our democracy. So that proximity through the creation of a corporate existence to state-level democracy has great significance. Changing this balance, and so this is where we get it, really any aspect of the federal role, but I would say primarily, as I'm focused right now on the creation of an expanded or new national charter for financial institutions, deemed to be in the business of banking, this has really far-reaching consequences that must be carefully considered. And in a world where there are things that are new, there's much that isn't new, but there are things that are new that technology is bringing to financial services, we have to think carefully and not do just what is expedient for some, but consider what supports the most essential elements of our separation of powers. And I would argue that what the OCC has proposed in terms of a really new charter for uninsured financial institutions deemed to be in the business of banking, which is a broad range of powers, is very consequential. And that defining these institutions without deposit insurance really will expand the reach and of these institutions and the potential, and this is really essential to focus on, the potential safety net of the federal government. And that too has consequences, both state and federal, as well as, you heard from Brian in our thinking, the marketplace, the competitive marketplace, and the idea of picking winners and losers. I would raise at this point, what problems are we trying to solve? Brian identified some. And is the OCC trying to solve with a federal charter? As Brian laid out, the claim is that a state system is impeding innovation and that it would level the playing field. And I want to speak to both of those issues. So first, on the idea of innovation, we have seen that the numbers don't bear this out. Yes, there's friction in our state system, and there certainly is friction in our federal system in the creation of new financial institutions or the operations of any financial institution. But the state system has allowed for hundreds, if not thousands, of new financial institutions in the last decade, many of which would be considered fintechs. And many of those have gone national more quickly than we've ever seen, being able to navigate what Brian, I think, rightly points out is a system that can be challenging to navigate around licensing. But navigating that system and growing to a national basis very quickly. At the same time, we have seen, and you probably could count on one hand over the same period of time, the level of new bank charters. And there are a number of reasons for this. Some may be specific to the bank model, the insured depository model, but I would say it's also fundamental to our the regulatory role of the federal government in our banking system. So its strengths have been, I would argue, stabilizing through through the federal safety net that's created in a couple different ways, stabilizing a financial system of core banks, insured depositories, but necessarily risk averse given the exposure of the taxpayer through the creation of this safety net. And the safety net takes a couple different forms and then some beyond that. So in the case of banks, there is deposit insurance, which protects individual depositors. There is the liquidity provided and the lender of last resort function provided by the Federal Reserve. And then chartering outside of banking, you think of a Fannie or Freddie, then it has been interpreted as an implicit federal guarantee that also has stabilized things like housing finance. But this has come at a cost, and we've been dealing with that cost for the last decade, which may be one of the reasons we have so few bank charters, but it is trying to balance out the interest of the taxpayer and the economy, the broader consumer, and the financial institutions to allow for a competitive marketplace, but also a stable marketplace that doesn't put taxpayers at risk. It is inherently conservative, and so I think the idea that this introduces innovation into this federal role, particularly as a chartering authority, would introduce greater innovation into the system, I would challenge. The second point on introducing the federal government as a chartering authority of leveling the playing field doesn't add up to me either, in that it's not, and I don't think that a federal charter should be mandatory. Again, the strength of our system, I believe, has been, and the diversity of our system has been, the state chartering authorities and the primacy of the states and corporate law. But the level of leveling of the playing field doesn't add up to me, because it would only apply whatever standards to a national charter, and that would be self-selecting. So the incentive to come to the national charter wouldn't necessarily be to come to a higher standard for the purpose of leveling, requiring more of you to level the playing field between you and an insured depository competitor. There are other ways, if leveling the playing field is our objective, to achieve that through the federal government. So as I pointed out, the role of the federal government in financial services has had some benefits and some significant benefits around stabilizing our financial system, but costs that seem to me to be a mismatch for a world of innovation that has lived by a mantra of grow fast, fail fast, so that you can test and retest ideas. Fail fast doesn't fit in very well to our banking culture. I think Brian might add that it should, but to expect that is going to change, I think is an unrealistic and maybe an unwise expectation, given the risks of failure in our financial system. The presence of the federal government has also allowed financial institutions to grow larger. I think you probably could argue operate globally with maybe some greater ease, though we have large and global institutions that are not chartered by the federal government. I would say, is that worth taking away some of the separations of powers and the checks and balances of our system and our democracy, and creating a cradle-to-grave protection of a certain corporate interest and pursuing the success of that corporate interest over some of these other interests? I would say it's not worth that, and that we should think very, very carefully about this option, and that's why we're litigating this. As I mentioned, and as Brian mentioned, there are some benefits that come with that national charter. And as the previous comptroller had mentioned, and again, this speaks to the risk aversion, they would most likely pick proven business models, so larger institutions. And at a time of innovation where things are changing quickly, to expand the role of the federal government in picking who those beneficiaries are most certainly will result in some element of winners and losers. I'd like to turn now to the state system and where we are. We certainly are defending certain elements from the 18th and 19th century, but we are not defending a 19th century model of financial regulation. The states over the last decade in the non-bank space have been working to create a more seamless system of multi-state licensing and supervision. We started first with mortgage supervision, and we have had good cooperation with Congress and state legislatures working together to create a certainly not perfect, but much more collaborative and coordinated system of licensing and supervision. We have worked over the last 3 or 4 years to extend that to other areas of state licensing and supervision, primarily money service businesses, as Brian mentioned, and secondarily, but also of significant importance, consumer credit lending. We have most recently, so on the MSB side, where we did see innovation posing some new challenges around payments. We started back in 2013 an Emerging Payments and Innovation Task Force to look at state laws and were they appropriate to regulate those who were looking to create new payment systems through blockchain, and have been speaking as a system around those issues. Most recently, we have started back in May, we announced a broader vision for state licensing regulation that covers really all of non-depository financial services. We are prioritizing those two areas I just mentioned, but our Vision 2020, which is to create a much easier system to navigate and communicate with state regulators to consider a whole range of issues on how this system might function better, to better understand the points of friction for fintech companies. We just closed out an application process for fintechs to apply to an advisory panel, and we will be looking to announce within the next month who the members of that advisory panel are. We received, I think, about 50 applications from fintech firms, from the very largest to from small entities, to participate in this process. As Brian, I think, really appropriately noted, there are differences between a federal interest and a cradle-to-grave federal role in fintech and financial innovation, and I think we should focus on some of those differences in a path forward. The system that we have that does have checks and balances, that does promote, though it has been eroded over the years, and I think to some negative consequence, a separation of powers, is something that is, I think, to be supported and promoted rather than run over in an effort to promote innovation. With that, I think I'm at my time, and would turn it over to you, Wayne. Certainly a lot more that I could talk to, but I think it'd be even more interesting to hear the questions from our audience or any that you might have, Wayne.
Thank you, John. Yes, there's a lot more that we can talk about, and we'll certainly get into a lot of that. You've been listening to John Ryan, who is President and CEO of the Conference of State Bank Supervisors. What I'd like to do now is give a brief opportunity to John and Brian to interact with each other just very briefly, and then we will open the floor to you, the callers, for your questions. So turning now to Brian, any comments that you'd like to make at this point?
Well, sure, and I'll be brief because I too would like to get to the questions. I guess the one thing, you know, I think the, some of the concerns John raises are completely valid, and one of the risks about getting this type of or one of the beauties, I should say, of this new these new models is they have the potential to be viable without being a depository, and therefore without implicating the depository insurance and that issue, which is where a lot of the conservatism that you know may or may not be justified in the depository context, and that's a debate for a different time. But you know that can all be sidestepped. Now the concern is, of course, with the OCC, they do have a bank regulatory culture. And in fairness to them, and one other thing I should have mentioned that Congress could do is, with the exception of uninsured state banks and a few other minor exceptions, banks can't go through bankruptcy. They have to go through a receivership. On the other hand, these financial services firms that are non-banks could be resolved through bankruptcy. So one other change Congress could consider is at a minimum allowing non-depository state or federal banks to go through bankruptcy rather than a receivership. And that going that road would help, I think, address some of these concerns about the unduly conservative nature or the pressures that the bank regulator is going to face in a case where absent the deposits without the deposits, it weakens the justification of lender of a last resort. Like, you know, the goal is to get these firms and every firm we can, including, I would argue, traditional banks, to a point where they can fail. And we say, well, sorry, you know, we're going to wrap this up via bankruptcy and resolve it like you were any other company, I think that would be a better place to do it. The one other point thing I'd point to is I think John's concern about the OCC picking winners and losers is fair. I would argue, though, that current federal law also kind of picks winners and losers. The winners are the banks. The losers are anyone who isn't a bank because of the regulatory advantages. And so while we need to be careful that we're not allowing the OCC to pick winners and losers, we also need to acknowledge that the status quo has some of those problems as well and talk about what can be done to address those. And with that, I'll wrap it up.
Thank you, Brian. John, any comments you'd like to make before we open the floor to questions from our callers?
No, I think we can just go ahead and open it up.
Okay, then let's open the doorways. And you have been listening to John Ryan, Conference of President and CEO of the Conference of State Bank Supervisors, and Brian Knight, Senior Research Fellow for the Financial Markets Working Group at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Now we'd like to hear from you, our callers. Any questions you'd like to put to these two distinguished panelists?
In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star on your phone and then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, ask a question. Please enter the star key and then the pound key on your telephone keypad.
Wes, as we're waiting for some questions to line up, let me put a question to John Ryan here, if I may. John, there are some who surmise that the CSBS objection to the OCC plan for fintech chartering is just another chapter in the 150-year-old tug-of-war between the state and federal chartering of banks. Is that view accurate?
So I guess I could answer that the just is the part that I might disagree with. But, what's underlying that debate on the role of the states and the federal government is consistent over history. And it is, again, the separation of powers and the proximity of decision-making to the local level, the ability of local capital to invest, use the leverage of the banking system for local economic development versus models where you really had to go to the federal government to, other models other than the United States, where you had to go to a centralized government to seek any permission to exercise powers. So, yes, in the sense that this issue of local control and local accountability versus centralized power has been fairly timeless in our democracy. What is different is that banking is being broadly defined and without some of the issues that we've had, at least since the creation of the Fed and the FDIC, which are really the primary roles of the federal government, which is the backstop that it provides to stabilize the financial system in times of crisis. And so potentially expanding, and Brian tried to counter that with the idea that these could be federal corporate entities that would be subject to bankruptcy law and all the other things that any other corporation could be. I would say history would show us differently, that the federal government has used this authority to a limited degree to promote certain business models and then exercised a federal backstop to preserve those business models, and that this is a broad, in the course of the 150 years, one of the broadest expansions of that authority.
Wait, if I could just hop in really quick.
Sure, go ahead.
Just to clarify, my comment about bankruptcy was not just with regards to federally chartered entities. I mean, in the hypothetical where the law is changed to allow state non-depository, we'll call them banks, just for the sake of argument, right? But state non-depositories as well, that bankruptcy issue would apply to them or could apply to them as well, right? So In fact, it might even be easier thinking back on the bankruptcy provision in question. So the goal here is not to have, or at least my goal here, is not to have a federally chartered entity. The goal, my goal is to address these regulatory problems that we're seeing. And a federally chartered entity is one possible solution. State chartered or licensed entities are another. It's addressing the problems that the status quo has. And one of the risks about going into the banking system, as John mentions, is conservatism / absolute fear of failure, and getting these entities to a point where they can be resolved like a normal corporation. And I think there are ways to do that. And I think there are ways to do that while protecting the consumers, in particular, because we're not talking about depositories. That's the goal. State or federal, that's lower down on my concern list.
Thank you, Brian. Wes, do we have any questions from our callers at this point?
We do. We'll go now to our first audience question. Once you hear the prompt, you may ask your question.
Hi, gentlemen. This is Tony Cotto, former NAIC staffer, and I actually would love to hear your thoughts on bundled products and sort of the trend that we're seeing of non-financial institutions wanting to be financial service providers, and also the world in which credit cards and banks and even to a lesser extent insurance companies are offering other products that are not regulated in the same way, like, say, travel benefits. Would love to get your thoughts on sort of the world we're entering here.
John, you want to take a first stab at that?
So we've long had the issue, and Wayne Bryan and I had talked about offline about what some would view as arbitrage, or sort of a skirting requirements and redefining products. Technology and a web-based system makes offering these things easier. My view is that like products should probably be regulated in like ways, and that we can find different ways to achieve that, and I think even through our state federal system.
Brian, any comments?
Well, I would agree that, I think I agree with John in the sense that like regulation should be justified by the risk it's legitimately addressing. So, to the extent that a firm, the two firms offer the same product that generates the same risk, we should probably assume that they're going to be regulated the same. And there will be exceptions to that in terms of like maybe total complexity, or if one company is paying for the product with the insured deposits and the other is paying for it with risk capital that an investor put up. There can be differences there, and we can parse that really finely if we had an extra 3 hours. But I do think the other thing I'd say in terms of arbitrage is, arbitrage gets a bad rap, but I think we should think about it in part as people, companies arising to serve the needs of people, and we should wonder if we're seeing a lot of arbitrage in a space. We should honestly ask, is this a case where regulation is preventing people from getting their needs met in the most efficient way? An example you could point to is the fact that due to pressure from regulators, banks really have trouble making small dollar loans to customers with relatively poor credit. That doesn't take away those customers' need for credit, but they go to the next best solution. And we should be wondering if we see arbitrage, is that a sign that, hey, our regulations are causing more harm than good?
Great. Shall we proceed to the next call? Next question from our callers.
While we wait for another question from our audience, I'd like to announce that our next Teleforum conference call is scheduled for Monday, August 7th at 2 p.m. That call will be on a litigation update on the UT Austin lawsuit over race-based admissions. Please keep an eye out for emails announcing our upcoming Teleforum calls. You can also visit the full schedule on our website, fedsoc.org. On the website, you can also find all previously recorded Teleforum calls as podcasts that you can download or listen on our website. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please enter the star key and then the pound key.
While we're waiting for another question, I'd like to put one that I think is, I'm sensing sort of a coming together on sort of a view here, and I want to try to probe that a little bit more. The case is often made, and John will know this case very well, that the U.S. banking system and its customers have benefited from our dual banking system, that this regulatory competition has created an environment that is more open to innovation than you would have if there were a single bank chartering and supervisor agency. Does that theory, that logic, also apply for non-bank financial services providers, both the federal and a state chartering ability?
So I would say yes, potentially. I mean, the challenge you need to really benefit from that type of competition is you need, you know, what they call market-preserving federalism, which is, you know, and one of the essential components there is that the customer in the market is able to find the service that they like the best, and therefore there's competitive pressure. If you know, the incumbents in a particular jurisdiction are able to exclude competition from outside that jurisdiction, you're not getting the benefits of competitive federalism. And so while I personally would not want a world where the only option for these fintech firms to effectively compete is a national bank charter, you know, and so the state should be involved, you know, you're going to need that market preserving competitive federalism to actually work, and that means you're going to need to be able to firms are going to be able need to be able to compete nationwide with each other.
John, any comments on that question?
Yes. I would say, so when we refer to the dual banking system, for those on the call who are aware, you know, it's a system of national bank chartering and state chartering. What has facilitated the greatest innovation or competition in that system is that the states continue to charter, license, and regulate banks. And both the OCC and the states do this, but there's been a greater interest at the state level in new market entrants than we often see at the federal level, given, you know, our interests. And so what we've seen, you know, with a series of financial crises over the last decades is a more conservative federal government that has made it a little harder for innovation and for competition within that system, and we're actually seeing more innovation and competition outside that system. So to increase the federal chartering role, I don't know if that's going to promote greater innovation. I think that if that's the goal, then that's probably not the way to get there. If we're worried about the stability of the system and the players in the system, then an increased federal role, and I don't think you need the federal government as a chartering authority to achieve that, is maybe more what you're looking to. But an environment where we've been looking to solve our too big to fail issues, the history and the role of the federal government has been to allow institutions, banking institutions, to be more highly leveraged, hold less capital over period of time, and has promoted the interest of large financial institutions and even protected the interest of those institutions. So extending what at least has been our history to a broader universe, I think might work against innovation and competition.
Great. Thank you, John. Wes, questions from callers?
Looks like there are no questions pending right now. Again, if you'd like to ask one before this call ends, please type in the star button and then the pound button on your keypad.
Well, I have one more that I've really jotted down. I would love to have your views on, both of you. Innovation, as you both have mentioned, has always been part of the American economy, and particularly financial services. Is there anything new in the current environment about innovation, or is this just what we're seeing now is what we've always been seeing?
So I mean, that's an interesting question. I guess it depends on sort of what you define as new, because there are some like relatively novel innovations around, you know, in terms of technology around things like machine learning for underwriting or distributed ledger technology. But you know, the history of this has been that people have needs, and for whatever reason, they can't get those needs met, or they can't get those needs met in a satisfactory manner. And some entrepreneur determines that there is an option there, and they leverage their you know, new technology, new innovation, or take existing technology and innovation and apply it in a unique way to meet the needs of customers. And so, you know, these lenders are using the internet as a delivery mechanism, so they're avoiding the cost of branches and all of that. They're using newer, innovative model or underwriting models that they seem to think will help them better price people. And there's some evidence that at least some of the firms that's true. And then relatively new funding models, in the sense that instead of relying on a combination of bank equity and deposits, they are using investment from, originally it was individuals, and now more it's institutions, and in fact occasionally some banks. And so, you know, it's not like things have been you know, frozen in amber and suddenly there's innovation. I think what we're seeing, though, is some really interesting coming together of innovation. And, you know, some of this innovation has been driven by pre-existing regulatory issues. And so you're seeing people trying to get around existing regulatory blocks. And so, and I would argue that, like, one thing we need to keep in mind, at least on the lending side, is, yes, a lot of these entities are outside of the federal banking system, but they are partnering with banks, right? So they are leveraging, if not a federal charter, at least the federalization of certain aspects of lending law to compete. And if you take that away, it becomes questionable whether or not they become viable. And so, you know, I think we should be mindful that some of this innovation is being driven by regulatory problems.
John, what do you think? Is there anything you see that is new in the climate for innovation?
So often when I've spent a good bit of time thinking about this, and I identify something that feels new, and then I start to follow that line, and I get to some sort of precedent. So there is a lot that's not new. But what feels different, if not new, is the speed of change. And because the cost of the flows of information are so low, and the ability to process enormous amounts of data, and the Internet as a delivery system, there is an impatience that feels different than what we've experienced in the past. We have new, which isn't new, but it's new to our time, financial interests in the system, private equity, that's really interested in picking, and this may be the part that, again, I'm sure we can find historic precedents, but they're looking to pick the big winner, the unicorn, the market dominating player. And so they're spreading their bets around many entities. The ambition is not to grow something locally and then build from that or even stay local. It's to go national and global as quickly as possible and dominate. And again, I'm sure there's historic precedent, but it is different than at least the recent history of our banking system. So those are things that I'm experiencing.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Brian. Do we have any last calls, any questions from our callers, Wes, before we conclude this teleforum for today?
There are no current questions on the line.
Well, in that case, let me thank you for our listeners who are listening into us, and especially I want to thank Brian Knight and John Ryan for some excellent perspectives and a very good interchange.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all for joining us. On behalf of the Federal Society, I'd like to thank our experts for speaking and for Wayne Abernathy for doing a wonderful job moderating. We're grateful for their valuable time and expertise today. Thank you again for joining us. This call is now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.